That's the sounds of tens of thousands of demonstrators taking to the streets in Burma this week in defiance of the military regime. The Burmese ruling military junta cracked down violently on anti-government protesters today. It's reported that at least two people have died and hundreds of pro-democracy demonstrators have been arrested. Troops fired shots in the air, clubbed protesters, and made arrests to disperse crowds gathering in the former capital city of Rangoon. Massive demonstrations have been taking place on the streets of Burma for the past 9 days in defiance of the country's dictatorial military government, despite threats of persecution from the ruling junta and the deployment of military trucks. The protests have been led by Buddhist monks and reached a new high Sunday when an estimated 100,000 people took to the streets. What began last month as smaller-scale demonstrations against the government's decision to raise fuel prices is burgeoning now into a full-fledged pro-democracy movement. The recent protests have been the most visible challenge to long-standing military rule since 1988 and follow the recent closing of Burma's National Convention. Analysts decried the convention as a sham that sought to constitutionally consolidate military rule. We're joined on the line by Edith Morant. She's the director of Project Meiji, and she's also the author of Down the Rat Hole. Edith Morant, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about the historical context in which this is occurring. We've heard a lot about the recent smaller-scale protests, protesting against raising fuel prices, but this is the same country where pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has spent the better part of the past 18 years or so under house arrest. Talk to us about Suu Kyi's detention and what she represents to the greater pro-democracy movement.
Well, that movement is an alternative to decades of military rule since 1962. The military has been in charge of Burma and also waging a ruthless campaign in the frontier regions against ethnic people who have been in rebellion against them for many, many years. So this regime was almost overthrown in 1988 through a peaceful popular uprising, which we're kind of seeing an echo of these days. And at that time, Aung San Suu Kyi, the daughter of Burma's independence hero during the anti-British days, she was the most eloquent spokesperson for this new burgeoning democracy, this flowering of all kinds of freedoms in Burma that happened over a period of months in 1988. And then that was brutally cracked down on in September of 1988. And she was placed under house arrest for the first time, and nonetheless, her party won an election subsequently with over 80% of the vote. So the people of Burma spoke, and then they were not listened to, and she's remained most of the time under house arrest, the current period since May 2003. And yet there has been a democracy movement in Burma and among the exiles from Burma all along, just under the surface. And what we're seeing now is really the result of underground organizing from people who survived the 1988 uprising, who began the protests that are going on now, and then joined by the Buddhist Sangha, the monks and the nuns, who are an extraordinarily powerful moral and real force in Burma these days.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. These massive but very peaceful demonstrations have gripped Burma for more than a week now, and people like Desmond Tutu have spoken out in support of the movement. So Aung, who's a spokesperson for the National Council of the Union of Burma, has talked about what you just alluded to, which is monks having a moral authority in the country.
Yes, in our country, the monks are the highest moral authority of the society. And then when the monks take the leading role, you know, in the movement, that then people would follow, you know, eventually.
Edith Morant, can you acquaint us with the way that monks are seen in Burmese society? And were they as prominent in the movement about 20 years ago?
They were very prominent in 1988, and they were also very prominent in Burma in the anti-colonial struggles against the British rulers. And there are over 400,000 Buddhist monks and also there are many thousands of Buddhist nuns in Burma. Many people will go into the monkhood for a period of a few months or a year at certain parts of their life, certain transitional phases, and others are monks for the rest of their lives. And they're seen as people who are making many sacrifices on behalf of the rest of humanity. So when they chant, they basically chant for all of the rest of us, whether we're Burmese or anywhere else. Basically, it's, you know, they're agents for world peace. And every so often, they think locally as well as globally. And in this case, they became very active because some joined the demonstrations against the rising prices that were inflicted on the people by the government and were brutally beaten. Well, the irony of this is then more and more people joined in, and now in order to discourage them, they're brutally beating the monks again. So this is really, in a way, adding fuel to the fire of the people's frustrations throughout the country. And photographs have already come out of the monks with their shaven heads with blood on them and the violence that's been perpetrated against these revered figures in Burmese society. So if it's an attempt to intimidate the people, it might not work.
It does seem to be a very, very violent repression that the military has started to wage against this pro-democracy movement. What is it that the military junta fears?
Well, they're all about fear and they're all about violence. And this is a military which has got a lot of very young soldiers who are forced into it and are indoctrinated and even drugged. This is a military that uses rape as a tactic in the frontier areas, that uses forced labor, that does whatever it wants to the people. It's pretty taboo to do violence towards a Buddhist monk in that country, and yet obviously they have people who are so indoctrinated that they are willing to do that on command. Whether or not that's going to go on much longer, I'm not sure. I think there's going to be some breaks within the military itself. It's been compared to riding a tiger. You know, they are on top of this country by force, ruling it from their new royal capital, as they call it, Naypyidaw, in the center of the country. Very paranoid, very secretive, and yet quite aware that the minute they lose their grip on this tiger that is the nation of Burma, then they are no longer even in the running. At any point, they could have negotiated with Aung San Suu Kyi. They could have negotiated with the ethnic groups. They could have had national reconciliation, but instead they choose to use their troops. So their troops are probably about the same in number as the Buddhist monks of Burma. So it's 400,000 against 400,000.
And why don't they use diplomatic means then, if that's something that's available to them, and if there's so much international pressure for there to be a type of reconciliation?
They have a sort of cult-like belief in the military as the only force of merit in Burma, even above the monks. There was footage of one of the military leaders in civilian clothes bowing down to the monks the other day. As he was bowing down to the monks, he was threatening them. He was threatening them with this crackdown that's happening. So you have this spectacle of troops that have now, this night in Burma, have fanned out around the pagodas and monasteries of Burma to protect them from the monks, who are, of course, their rightful caretakers. This is, you know, this seems to be in their nature. This is what they do. They use their guns. And Aung San Suu Kyi has eloquently said in one of her comments when she was not under house arrest, "Don't be afraid. All they have are guns."
Wow.
And they have a lot of guns, but and yet that's a very powerful message to the people of Burma and the world, for that matter. And the people of Burma are showing the world what nonviolent protest really looks like. You know, it's not just facing down tear gas, but now it's this point where the monks and others are doing civil disobedience in the face of live ammunition.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Edith Morant. She's the director of Project Meiji and also the author of Down the Rat Hole. We're talking about Burma, where the ruling military junta cracked down very violently today on anti-government protesters there. Edith Morant, I wanted to ask you if these massive protests have caught you by surprise. Do you think it's something that's been simmering for a while? And does it really just have to do with the fuel prices or the National Convention or both?
There was going to be something that brought it on. Sometimes in Burma, it's something mystical, like the sighting of a ghost in a building. Sometimes it's just one more straw, you know, added to the load that people carry economically, because the regime really skims everything off of that country. All the foreign investment goes straight into their pockets. Several months ago, there was a video released of the wedding of the daughter of the top general, where she got millions of dollars in wedding presents, and she was bedecked in diamonds like a Christmas tree. All of these little things eventually add up, and it's like the Langston Hughes poem, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or does it explode?" And in this case, it exploded in a very peaceful, disciplined fashion, because these people who survived the 1988 uprising learned from that, and they've used their time studying nonviolent change, and the monks know all about nonviolence themselves. So it's been very well organized. And at first, I know a lot of the sort of pundits were saying, oh, it's not going to go anywhere. People are too afraid in Burma. There's such a climate of fear there. I said, it's just a few activists left over from 88. You know, it's not going to go anywhere. The monks aren't in it, you know. And then the monks were in it, and people said, oh, no, it's not going to go anywhere because the people aren't in it. So as of Sunday, you know, obviously it was going somewhere, and people are calling it the Saffron Revolution and so on. And it is a revolution. And if it gets suppressed now through the force of guns, it will come back within a few months. And that's really what the pattern was in 1988. It started in March that year and built over the summer of that year. The difference is that this time the rest of the world really is watching, and there is diplomatic pressure as much as possible going on. And the media being smuggled out of Burma is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's not only a saffron revolution, but it's a YouTube revolution for sure.
I wanted to ask you as well about some of the other economic and political hardships that people face in Burma, and would, you know, as one of the reasons that people might join anew or might, you know, stay with the movement for the past 20 years.
Well, it is one of the poorest countries in the world, despite being extremely rich in resource, everything from rubies and platinum to natural gas reserves, massive ones are there. But all of that has been taken by the military junta in joint ventures, often with multinational companies, including petroleum companies from the United States, like the former Unocal that was bought by Texaco and Total of France. And the forests of Burma have been logged by their neighbors, by Thailand and China. None of this benefits the people who often live on the water that you cook rice in as and pretend it's soup. You know, that's one of the meals a day. That's very standard in most parts of Burma. People are particularly incensed about the fuel price doubling, and that's not because they have an SUV to drive around in. That just means that the price of the bus that you have to take to work with, you know, a crowd of 50 other people on the bus has basically doubled or even tripled. So it's really making life even more impossible than usual, and that's certainly added to the frustrations, but it's not just economics by any means.
And finally, I wanted to ask you, the Bush regime is calling for sanctions. The UK, the EU, China, India, they've all weighed in. Is this purely symbolic, or will that actually serve to sway the military regime in any way?
Well, it's pretty much agreed that China holds the cards on the regime, if anybody does, if they're not just so in a own state of their own delusions at this point, that they're beyond even China talking to them. but China has such strong economic interests in Burma, and they're also all worried about instability on their borders when they're having their big Olympics show in China. So it does seem that, China are there either for good or bad. As far as the United States, we already had a pretty strong sanctions on Burma and a very good Burma policy, very proactive through successive administrations. The new sanctions did not involve bringing Texaco out of Burma. However, we still have a major U.S. petroleum multinational in a direct venture with this regime. So that's worth remembering. But, yeah, basically these days, as much pressure on China to try to do something about their dear friends in Burma would be the most useful strategy.
Edith Morant, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you.
We've been speaking with Edith Morant. She's the director of Project Meiji and also the author of Down the Rat Hole.